again.
You're listening to Industrial Evolution. I'm your host, Chad Perry, CTO and software engineer. You can find more episodes and contact information on our website, industrial.fm. Enjoy the show, and if you need help with custom software, data integrations, or strategy, be sure to reach out. That's industrial.fm. Hey everyone, in this episode, we're speaking with John McElhinney, Corporate VP of Strategy at PTC. This conversation is coming right on the heels of our interview with Steve Dertien, CTO at PTC, who talked about the evolving role of SaaS and cloud in engineering organizations. The reason that's relevant is that PTC, in its quest to enable a SaaS and cloud-based future for their customers, recently acquired Onshape, the cloud-based 3D CAD tool. And John, with us today, is the co-founder of Onshape. But it gets better, because even if you haven't heard of Onshape, you've almost certainly heard of SolidWorks, for which John was the longstanding CEO all the way through the SolidWorks acquisition by Dassault and beyond, until he and the founder of SolidWorks moved on to found Onshape. So John is here to share a wealth of experience around innovation at engineering-focused companies, including lessons learned and techniques that you can apply to any size organization. This is about as close as we can get to a blueprint for success, because John's insights form the DNA for innovation at any size organization, and that is to align every single person in your business behind a common goal that demands new approaches and a deep understanding of your customers' problems. So with all that said, John, absolutely a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks, Chad. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, I know I already gave a little history, but would you mind, in your own words, giving us the high level on how you got here and what drives you?
Sure. Way back when PCs first started, I was at the University of Rochester studying mechanical engineering. And my summer internship was working at the Laboratory for Laser Energetics. This is a trillion-watt laser focused on nuclear fusion energy. Imagine three football fields long. That's sort of the size of this laser. And that summer, I worked with a gentleman who was running the mechanical design department. And when I first walked in, we had drafting boards and drawings were all over the place and completely disorganized. And quickly, I think I got the backhanded compliment of, John, you're better at computers than you are design. Maybe you can help us find a CAD system. And PC CAD systems were just coming around at that time. So that summer, basically, I helped research a CAD system. I found a way to mechanically store all of our drawings, you know, through these hanging sort of equipment that we found to, you know, handle the 5,000 plus drawings that we had. And also, I came up with kind of a numbering schema system, and using DBase, wrote a drawing retrieval system to try and help organize the data. And, you know, here I am almost scarily 40 years later, helping people find a CAD system, helping them organize their data, and helping improve their design process. And along the way, of course, I had the good fortune of working at Computer Vision, which was a sort of pioneer in the CAD space. Also was very early at SolidWorks, along with the whole team there. And again, had the pleasure of running that organization as a CEO for about 7.5-8 years. And then joined a small little startup cloud company as the cloud was really coming about in late 2007, early 2008. And that ultimately got acquired by Verizon, and then got together with John Hirschtick and a lot of the original SolidWorks team when we saw some real sort of changes in terms of mobile computing and cloud and the opportunities that would afford us to kind of really rethink the product design process. And then we created Onshape, and now we're part of PTC. So it's been a wonderful journey and sort of in helping people transform the product development process.
So the topic at hand is this idea of a blueprint for digital innovation. In other words, what does it take to be truly innovative, regardless of the size of an organization? And what I'd like to do is start with a little fable that can anchor that conversation. But I think it would be more appropriate for you to tell us the story of the little bird.
Well, you know, one of the things that if you deal with any of the investment community in the venture capital space and a lot of startup companies, there's a sort of quest. The key thing that you're ultimately trying to figure out is what's called product market fit. And that is, have you developed a product or a service or an offering, and what part of the market values that product that you're offering? And, you know, it's a humbling journey often, because what you think customers may value and what they and what you've built or what you're proposing, sometimes they have a totally different view of the world. And so over the years, you know, I often joke about the little children's book, which is this book that I remember reading to my children that was about this little bird that was in a nest and all of a sudden fell out of the nest. And the bird keeps going around to different animals on the farm, whether it's a chicken, the dog, or the cow, you know, saying, "Are you my mother? Are you my mother?" And the idea is he's trying to find who his mother is. And finally, he finds a steam shovel, and the steam shovel brings it and puts it back in the nest. But this whole idea of trying to figure out the product market fit is very much like that journey, which is the only way you can figure out whether you have product market fit is you've got to talk to a lot of people. And it's shoe leather, it's perseverance, it's courage, that you've just got to talk to many, many people, help them see what it is that you're trying to do, and then hear and see their feedback so that you can iterate and ultimately converge on the value of your product or your service offering for what the market is looking for.
I can already think of so many barriers to doing that in a startup and in a large established organization. There would be different barriers, but I could see people immediately saying, well, that's going to be really hard because of X, Y, or Z. Now, you have this other analogy, or this more like this this phrase that you mentioned, and I'd like to hear a little bit more about that and how that plays in. And this idea that events force action. So how does that fit into this idea of product market fit?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, it's something I say and have said over the years at the various organizations that I've been part of, which is it really, if you think about it, in the United States, and I know we have a worldwide audience, but in the United States, April 15th happens to be a very special day. It's not a day that we all look forward to, but it's a day that we must actually respect, which is that's tax day in the United States. And the question is, why do millions and millions of Americans ultimately pay their taxes on April 15th? And the reason is really simple. On April 16th, it's much more expensive if you didn't pay your taxes on April 15th. So the event of that day forces action for people to do things. And so if you think about, you know, the challenges for most organizations, in larger organizations, you know, the challenge is you just got organizational bureaucracy and you just got inertia, right? People are just used to sort of doing things the way that they do them. And so while in large organizations, you'll see slogans that sort of say, the only constant thing is change. And yet most of the organization doesn't want to change. And then in startups, you know, you're all about change. The only advantage you have as a startup, the only advantage you have is time. I mean, yes, you can have resources, but you don't have market share. You know, you don't have unlimited resources, and you don't necessarily have customers yet. So the one advantage you have is the ability to execute quickly and iterate and change if you need it. And so this idea of forcing the organization, whether you're a large company or a small one, by deadlines, by setting up customer meetings, you know, it forces you to kind of get your value proposition aligned, present it to customers, get feedback, whether that's a large organization or a small one. So this idea of putting events out there, not just calendar events, but things that force you to commit yourself to, which is a customer or a prospect. So setting up a phone call, setting up a demonstration, it creates an obligation that you have to meet. And that forces the organization to kind of converge and actually make decisions. So it's a very powerful tool to help manage projects, which is creating these events that expose yourself a little bit, that puts you out there over the tips of your skis.
Yeah, you're really talking already about a practical way that you can approach this. So how does that fit into an overall strategy of trying to move toward a more digitally innovative organization?
Some of the original founders of IDEO, which is a well-known product design firm on the West Coast, you know, they talk about the process of innovation. They talk about observation as being one of the most powerful things. And let me just sort of turn back the clock, if I can, just a little bit to give an example about the power of observation and how that can spur innovation. Back prior to, you know, in the early days of SolidWorks, three people, John Hirschtick, Bob Zafanti, who was a co-founder at SolidWorks, and another gentleman by the name of Steve Krug. Steve Krug is a UI user experience expert. He's written a couple books Rocket Surgery Made Simple and Don't Make Me Think is another book. And in Don't Make Me Think, my favorite chapter, I think it's chapter 9, which is, it sort of says, eliminate unnecessary words, and it's got unnecessary crossed out. Anyway, those three people early on went to visit a customer. This is before the founding of SOLIDWORKS, before code was really written. And they went to watch this gentleman use a CAD system. He was happening at the time using Pro Engineer at a company called Nichols Aircraft. And they made manifolds. It was sort of plates with a bunch of holes in it. And they asked the gentleman to kind of just do some modeling and explain what he was doing, but just keep doing his normal work. And what he was doing is he had this, you know, big monitor, and it was a Silicon Graphics box. And the monitor was sort of an abnormally distanced from kind of a normal sort of face to screen kind of distance. And in between, he used a little 3M stick'em notes. And what he was doing was actually doing some modeling. And at the time, kind of mapping out the sort of structure of the parametric changes that he was making. And as he would do Edline, move this feature number to this feature number, he would take the 3M stick'em note and change the sort of hierarchy of the different parts. Anyway, that's not the important part. The important part afterwards, after the observation, is the three people got together, and Steve Krug, who really knows, you know, we joke with him, is that he doesn't really know a lot about CAD. He spells CAD with a K. You know, Steve sat back there and said, what this person was really trying to do was interact with the graphics and also kind of have a structure and a topology of how that interacted. And that ultimately came up with the idea of the feature manager that every CAD system uses now. And so if you look up that patent, it's Bob Zafonte, Steve Krug, and John Hirschtick. And every CAD system came about because of that observation of watching somebody use the system. And so it wasn't like somebody had a spec and said, oh, create a feature manager that does this. No, it came about, that innovation and inspiration came about by observing what people were trying to do and then understanding how some of the technology could support that. So organizations, again, large or small, the power of innovation comes through knowledge about current processes in observation.
Yeah, this is right down to the core of it, which is understanding the problem, really deeply understanding the problem that you're trying to solve. And I hear this anecdotally in so many different contexts. I mean, inside of engineering and outside of engineering, I think of it kind of in parallel to this idea of first principles as well, right? Where you go back to what is the outcome that you're trying to accomplish, and what are the inputs? And the thing that happens in between a lot of times is leftover from us accommodating maybe what we didn't have access to before. So is that kind of how you think of the problem and where it fits in, or is there maybe a better model for that?
No, I think you're spot on. I think one of the challenges, of course, when you're coming up with solutions is a lot of times we come in with biases we don't even realize we have. And the venture capital world is famous for this, where they do pattern recognition. Oh, three other companies that we funded before did this, and they kind of look at a problem and say, therefore, we can apply this. You know, that's useful, having sort of abstract or models that you might have built previously are important to sort of balance your thought processes against. But I think, you know, I think John Hirschtick has a great statement. You know, as much as I say events force actions and other things that I have, one of his statements is that, you know, the most dangerous decisions that you make are decisions you don't even realize you're making. And so our implicit biases, when we look at it, we automatically want to apply technology or solutions to problems without necessarily really stepping back, as you sort of say, to sort of first order principles. What is it that the person is really trying to accomplish? To go back to that example of the creation of the feature manager, they didn't go to Nichols Aircraft to go and say, let's create a feature manager. They went to see and observe, and seeing the challenges, you know, that was a very creative solution that this person had come up with using 3M sticky notes to try and create a hierarchy. But the problem the person really was having is they were having sort of this notion of wanting to interact with a highly graphical environment, which, of course, that's what product design and CAD systems support. But yet, the notion in the back of the person's mind is understanding the structure, how these pieces fit together. And so I think, you know, first order principles, observations, and being cognizant that we have implicit biases at least free you up to be able to sort of then, you know, hopefully find some breakthrough solutions to solve those core problems.
There's probably some wisdom to be had in there that perhaps your potential customers already have the solution that they need, but just not in a way that is convenient to them.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, I think you're exactly right. That's why I said the real creative part was this individual who was sort of building that hierarchy and that structure. And I think the insight of some people who were familiar with technology said we can take that structure, we can take that graphics and make them sort of work interoperably. And then from there, of course, it laid the foundation for how millions of engineers sort of work with a system that then were built upon to do other things from the feature manager.
I'm seeing this kind of ping pong back and forth over this iterative process where you've got this idea of, okay, you're a startup or an existing organization, regardless of who you are, you want to innovate. And so you want to catalyze some sort of action. So you potentially create events around that action, schedule some sort of meetings with your potential customers or potentially internally or whatever it is. And then you make observations. And so here is part of the critical part of it is you make keen observations. You go in with an open mindset. The customer potentially has a solution or they're doing something. I mean, they're obviously getting by without you at the moment. And then you get this information back. And then now you understand the problem. But there's a next step beyond that. And that is once you have what you think is a solution, you have to communicate the value of that solution back to the customer. Otherwise, they never become your customer. So how does that fit into this?
Yeah, well, that's when we get to the story of, you know, are you my mother? That is ultimately deciding product market fit. Let me just hit the rewind button for a second to reflect on one of the points you're making, that when you go and see a customer, you know, customers rarely will they tell you the solution, rarely. And a lot of times they don't necessarily even know that they have a problem because they just kind of, you know, we're pretty good as humans to be able to adapt to situations, right? And so many times they kind of, you know, deal with the current limitations of their current structures and they create processes to try and manage that. And so it's the keen observer that kind of can look at their processes and say, oh, there's a better way. The danger of getting too far down a path, if you're somebody who's coming up with an idea, of committing too much resource or committing too much energy into a potential solution for a problem, is that you may be so wed to the solution that you're trying to sell the solution instead of really saying, did we build something that there's really being valued by a customer? So let's say you come back with kind of your first iteration of something and you want to show it to people and see what they think and get the observation. What you want to do is just do enough so that the person, the user or the potential customer can take the mental leap to say, oh, I see how these connect, but not so far that you're vested in the solution that then puts you into a channel that will bias your solution for the future. Because once you get that first iteration, then you want to test it. You want to see, do people really understand the value that you've tried to create and why it's different, why it's better, and why it may help them in terms of making their lives easier and better. So you've got to be careful not to go too far down the path. And, you know, there's a lot of techniques that are out there that can help you, you know, paper prototyping and, you know, high value ways to communicate without necessarily committing a ton of resources down that path. And it's not just about a ton of resources because large companies can throw a lot of money at it. The problem is you start cementing in the bias of the solution and then it's really hard to sort of, you know, break that concrete up and allow you to kind of take a different path.
You mentioned paper prototyping, which I think it's almost this rustic idea now in this time of high fidelity, highly collaborative tools where it's easy to just say, okay, I'm going to go in there and throw something together. But paper prototyping can be highly effective. And I think that you said that you used paper prototyping at some point in the early stages of Onshape, which wasn't that long ago. So tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, let me be really clear. There are some amazing wireframing concept communication tools that are great. And to the extent you can use them and you're fluent in them, that's great. But if you don't have them, there are other ways that you can communicate ideas. So let me give you a very specific example. We had the concept that mobile devices could really change how people interact in an engineering environment. Up until we created Onshape, you know, the way in which people dealt with disparate CAD formats and data formats between systems is sometimes people put them into neutral formats, or they put them into a viewer format that might be supported on a tablet or might be supported on phones, but they were kind of crude, and they were, you know, you kind of had to put it in these intermediate formats. Our feeling was with Onshape that the mobile device was going to be a first-class citizen, just like our browser-based solution. But before we committed to any code, what we did is we took some of the simple icons that we had in our desktop-based solution, and we brought in some users, and we said, okay, we want to do some simple tests. So we had one person that was leading the user scenario testing, and they asked the potential prospect or customers to actually start using our mobile device. Well, our mobile device was a piece of 8.5 by 11 paper, and it had little icons that we had cut out that we had screenshotted from our browser-based solution. And then what we had is we had a camera overlooking kind of the piece of paper and where the icons were set up. And we asked the person to sort of say, well, how would you start to build a box using this? Now, meanwhile, we were in another room watching the person and capturing it and understanding kind of some of the challenge. We asked the person to talk through what they were thinking, like, I can't find the line, you know, the sketch tool or whatever else. And so literally they would put their finger on it and move the sketch tool around. They would double click on it. And, you know, they would explain what they were expecting. And so it allowed us to kind of see inside of their mind how they were thinking about the problem. Now, obviously, then when we iterated on that, you know, we could then start to build some of the scaffolding and some of the skeleton tools to do wireframes behind it. But it was very powerful. That gave us, I'll call it, imagine you're going on a trip and you're driving. It was a compass heading. It told us to go north, east, south, or west. You know, you might want some further refined directions if you want to kind of get to your friend's house. But that gave us some really big compass headings straight out of the gate. And it was extremely powerful and zero cost.
That is such a wild story as a software developer. I mean, I started developing software in the mid to late 90s, and I was all about using the latest tools and everything. And so I wonder real quick, how did you know that that was going to work?
Well, Steve Krug, who I mentioned before, who was involved in the early days of SolidWorks, he's a friend of the company and early on at Onshape. He talked about kind of this whole user experience testing, and his thesis is the idea of having a one-way mirror and having big focus groups and trying to organize people and to see how people interact. Like, his feeling was, you know, get rid of that. Do a lot of iteration and do, you know, low cost, kind of direct with people, especially in developing products. And so, you know, he had suggested doing a paper prototype, and we set that up, and our feeling was, What did it take? I mean, we lined up four customers to come in half-hour intervals, and we spent 2 hours watching people do a simple task, and we got some very clear insights right away. And so Steve's book, Rocket Surgery Made Simple, was one of the key things early on that we said, let's just try it. You know, what's the downside?
Sometimes you just have to try stuff, and the lower the risk of trying those things, the more willing and the more able you are to take those risks. So I want to move on to some of the more practical steps about how you actually get people in an organization rallied around this cause, and what are some of the things that you need to do to create that innovative culture. But I want to take a quick aside here for a second and mention Onshape, the innovations of Onshape, because that is, I think, critical to understanding what's going on here and how truly innovative it was. So I think at its core, from my perspective, you had the versioning and ability to simultaneously work on this complex geometry. So can you give me a real quick rundown of what exactly was so innovative about Onshape?
Yeah, I mean, it starts with, you know, our observation and our thesis when we started the company was that the promise that we as an industry had made to people before with install-based desktop sort of software was, if you adopt our system, you'll gain the benefits of that sort of individual productivity. And then if you work with a team and your whole company adopts it and your supply chain, then all those benefits will accrue to you, the company. And what we found over time is that, one, standardization on one system is very difficult because companies get acquired, companies get divested, suppliers, things change. And so we realized that the notion that you're going to have a heterogeneous world versus completely homogeneous. Secondly, the big observation we had was that people were spending more and more time on the care and feeding of systems, and that was sort of becoming friction in their design processes. So we realized cloud, web, and mobile presented an opportunity. Like most good innovations, especially in the software world, platforms create opportunities for new leaders and new change. You know, Steve Jobs famously said when he was asked how he was going to beat Windows, he said, "We're not. We're going to wait for the next big platform and then crush it. You know, we're going to win it." And he, of course, did that in the entertainment space with the iPod, and that kind of led to the franchise changing. For us, we saw cloud, web, and mobile as a platform to change. And as we looked at it, the core issue that was causing all these problems was the atomic unit of how things were built. Is in install-based systems, it was files. And yet, in a cloud web-based system, we could make it be a database. So in the past, users had their sort of individual system. And to make sure they didn't step on each other's toes in an organization, they had a kind of an application running on top of that called PDM software, product data management software. And essentially, that was like a bank vault. Let me check things in. Let me check things out. And it helped to stop organizational chaos. And it was kind of the best we could do at the time, because that's all we could build, kind of given the infrastructure that we had. We looked at that and kind of threw that away. And what we really built was, at the core, we built a collaboration and sharing engine. And because it was database driven, it allowed us to have these sort of micro versions. And that allowed sort of this idea of simultaneous working. And so we had this collaboration sharing engine, and around it, metaphorically, we built the CAD system. And so at the core, it's collaboration and sharing, but it's at the atomic unit being a database. Secondly, that allowed us to have this idea of branching, like we have in the software world, and versioning. And then there's many other innovations on the mobile side. And so we looked at that and through a lot of iteration with customers, validated that, in fact, it kind of required a little bit of rethinking the process, but it created a whole new sort of way of thinking about design.
The reason I wanted to ask that and why I think it's so important is that the Onshape story reflects the broader trend of the market. It's like as you described it. So SolidWorks came along and had a big innovation. And then you talk about Apple waiting for the next platform. And my conversation with Steve, your counterpart over at PTC, was all about the evolving nature of SaaS and cloud. And so I know PTC is very dedicated to helping their customers get to that next level. And a lot of conversations around digital transformation in manufacturing are around collaboration and cloud-based tools. It's not about changing technology for technology's sake. It's about how we work, and we want to be more effective.
So I think one of the things that we have to observe about the engineering space is that in general, you know, the consumer world, our personal world, the world at large, marketing, sales, they tend to actually be the canaries in the coal mine, ultimately, that the engineering world sort of follows up to, if you will, in terms of transformations. Now, why is that? Well, by the nature of engineering, it tends to be conservative. But I also think that, remember, in design and manufacturing, all the little details matter. So the functionality bar to have a credible solution is very high. It's not a speed bump or a hurdle. It's a pole vault in terms of functionality that's required, because you can have all these benefits, but if you can't do that certain blend or that certain surface definition, then the solution may not necessarily be, you know, reasonable for somebody to go ahead and deploy. So the bar is very high versus a lot of consumer tech that we use in other areas of our businesses. So that's part of why it's a little bit of a lag to the normal world. Now, in terms of collaboration and sharing and organizations and how people are going to work, I think, you know, I think the nature of how people accept or reject sort of new solutions is, does it make my life easier? I mean, there's sort of a demographic side, and then there's just sort of personal side, like, is it more hassle or less hassle? Now, learning, and you got to think about these in two phases. There's sort of the non-recurring cost of learning a new system and a new process. And everybody has kind of heartburn with any kind of change. That's usually the resistance to change. But once you kind of have mastered the new system, the question is, have I made their lives better? Have I reduced the amount of friction? Have I reduced the amount of pain? And have I allowed them to do things that they didn't realize was possible? I mean, you know, the ability to, you know, to be able to access a CAD system on your friend, if you're at a friend's house for the weekend and somebody says, hey, can you take a look at something? And you can log in an incognito window on their browser and be able to access a design that in the past you need a specialized machine. Well, that allows you to kind of not have to go back to the office, not have, it's just, it provides possibilities that just were not there before. And so I think we have to be realistic about where we are in the transformation, and it's starting now. I mean, COVID certainly, what was a headwind turned into a tailwind, and it's happening. Cloud, web, mobile is happening. And it's going to transform everything that we do in the engineering space, like it has in every other discipline. Secondly, the question is, if you're just trying to mimic or replace the existing processes the way that they're done, you know, customers aren't going to get benefit. And, you know, of course, they'll be forced onto a platform, but they're not going to derive some of the benefits that allow them to really change their processes. And so organizational transformation is a key sort of potential roadblock, but there are strategies to deal with that. And certainly we've experienced that with many customers and have learned from that. And we've kind of prepackaged a bunch of things to aid in that transformation for other customers.
I'm hearing two related points here. One goes back to this idea of communicating the value of really anything clearly, whether it's a change or a new product, or whether it's internally you as the service provider, or whether you're trying to communicate with your customers. And then there's also the flip side of that, which is, what is the perspective of your employees, or perhaps what is the perspective of your clients if you're in consulting and transformation? So employees have to understand the greater context. They need a why, they need a purpose and a North Star. Where do you see that fitting into the role of transformation?
Yeah, I mean, if you go back and realize and really step back and abstract from what business you're in and just think about the motivation of employees, motivation of yourself, motivation of leaders about a company. If, you know, I think my view is the hierarchy is pretty simple. Like if you I like to sort of say from a communication standpoint, rather than write a lot of prose, you know, imagine if you grab a crayon and you hold it in your hand and you sort of say, me, Tarzan, you, Jane. Well, if you can communicate in the following ways and you think about how people are motivated, I think, especially with the newer generation, you know, people often think, well, compensation is one of the most important things for employees. I disagree. I think it starts with, you know, what is it that my company, my team, my organization is trying to do? You know, can I as an individual understand that, integrate it into my thinking, and do I believe in it? And then, you know, what is my organization's role in helping to achieve what the broader company or organization is trying to do? How am I doing in my job? Does that fit with things that I'm interested in? And then finally, am I fairly compensated appropriately to be able to support that? But that hierarchy and that priority, I think, is how we look at it. So I think with any employee, from, you know, the newest employee to the oldest employee, you know, the longest tenured employee, from the, you know, from perhaps an admin that recently joined the company to one of your key technical R&D people, I think they need to understand what it is that the company's trying to accomplish, the broader mission. Like, what is it? What's our raison d'etre? And then how do I fit in that? And that's when you get organizations to do things that are just not possible, you know, where you don't have that alignment. You know, that's the beauty of startups, and that's the beauty of teams, is that sometimes you can do some really incredible and impossible things, and really make a difference. You know, Steve Jobs famously said, you know, make a dent in the universe. It's just totally energetic when you realize all the challenges. I mean, startups are all about catch-22s. How do you resolve sort of those catch-22s? And there's millions of them, but keeping the context of why you're doing it. There's a million reasons why companies should fail, startups in particular, but there's usually one or two very good reasons why they should succeed. And focusing on those will allow the team to organize and kind of keep persevering during challenging times.
I think about SpaceX when I hear you talking about this. So they're no longer a startup, right? I mean, that's a large organization. They have thousands and thousands of employees, and yet they're still able to behave like a startup in terms of their rapid iterations and their outcome. It seems to me like a big part of that is the fact that it is very clear what their mission is. They want to get to Mars, and it is communicated very clearly. And then on top of that, there's a very, very powerful, visible feedback loop where they can see the progress that's being made. And so you can see, well, even if I only work on the first, you know, the first 1 inch of a rocket engine nozzle, I know that when I see that Starship lifting off, even when it comes crashing down, it still helps me understand where I fit into the world. And that is something that I think that you described previously as an emotional paycheck. So how do you reinforce this behavior if that's what you want out of an organization?
Amen. You describe what an emotional paycheck is. That's a phrase I use very, very frequently inside of our company. Because I think, you know, there's a broader purpose of why we work and what we do, especially in the engineering space. And so the idea of realizing in our world, we want to change how products are designed. We want to help people get products to market faster. We want to help eliminate waste. We want to make better products, you know? And so when you walk through and see in a store, you see online something that your customer has done using your product, there's just nothing better. I mean, when we recruit interns, you know, for the summer, for example, some of our developers inside of Onshape, they'll work with senior engineers side by side doing coding. And part of what we tell them is, if you come work for us for the summer, you're going to be expected to write code, and that code is going to end up in a shipping product, usually by the time you leave to go back to school. And they're going to learn in that process. So the expectation is pretty darn high. They're not going to read the phone book for the summer and go back to school. Like, they have to deliver. Now, it's beneficial for us, of course, because we get more horsepower and we get potential recruits for the future. But think about it, if you're a software developer, as an example, the fact that you can join a company and by the end of the summer, some of the work that you've done is actually being used by, you know, millions of people now, it's like in the education space or in the commercial space, it's just incredibly powerful. So the idea of taking what your broader mission is and then bringing it down to the individual user to understand their part in it. And your example of SpaceX is exactly on par of it's a great example of kind of that reinforcement mechanism, because that's the motivation of not letting down other people. How do we do it as an organization? For example, you know, we have company meetings. It started out very in the early days. We called it demo days. Every Friday, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we would have a company meeting and we'd kind of share some news about the company. And then all the developers would get up and show what they worked on for the past week. Now, that was great for two reasons. One, there was sort of peer pressure that they, you know, we haven't seen Joe stand up in about 3 weeks. What are you doing, Joe? Not that there was ever kind of accounted for like that. But on top of that, there was pride where people would show some of the functionality and you'd realize, you know, this vision that we had of how we're going to evolve and build the product, it was going step by step and we were making a ton of progress. And then we'd invite customers in to talk about how they were using Onshape and explain it. And so when you, and some of the most, you know, engaged people in those discussions were the developers, because they'd say, well, what are you missing? Or what do you need? And it would put extra sort of energy into the room to kind of go back and build, to work on the fin, you know, the control fin and on SpaceX, or to work on the nozzle, whatever it might be. So I think keeping people engaged. So having the developers, having people part of the company see actually how people are using our products, it's so critical. That is the feedback loop. That's the inspiration that keeps people going.
And you're describing a very razor thin line between, I would say, just collecting a paycheck, doing the bare minimum that's necessary. And I'm not saying this in a derogatory way either, but I am saying if you just take a mediocre company or a mediocre job situation where you're not unhappy, but you're also not happy. And then there's that line where you cross and you get this networked engagement super effect, this extra effort that leads to breakthroughs, ideas, new workflows, waste reduction. And to me, it sounds like that applies all the way from the CEO down to engineers and down to anybody else you can think of.
That is the definition of culture of a company, right? I mean, that's not something that you can put on a placard and put on the wall. That is the living, breathing sense of an organism. And so, you know, there was never pressure for people to stand up and hey, let me show you this functionality because I'm being told I have to do it. If you were just marking time, you wouldn't survive in a culture like Onshape, not because we'd spit you out, you would leave because you would feel too much peer pressure, or it may not be for you. And there's plenty of people that their personal situation, they're just, they look at work and it's, you know, it's their 40 hours a week and they're doing their job. And that's fine. That's probably not the people that we want to hire, because the broader mission creates an environment, a culture that people want to work harder, more deliberate. I'm not saying people are working 90 hours a week, but they feel a part of it and they feel a personal responsibility to it. And they're excited by it. You know, when you're creating things that were never created before, how wonderful. Most importantly, when you're creating those things and then you hear customers give you feedback. You know, we deliver releases every 3 weeks and we put it up. Our customers just simply log in and they get the benefits of it. But our forum, you know, you can see it every 3 weeks, what's new. And our customers immediately, you know, within a day and a half, you're getting thousands of views and comments. And, you know, they're like, how did you know I needed that? Well, guess what? You told us. You didn't realize you were telling us, but in our interactions, you did tell us. And so that's a really powerful feedback loop that kind of brings more people, in, more customers into it, but brings also future developers into it, which is what we're always looking for in terms of talent, not just developers, but people into the organization.
So let me see if I can summarize this and then bring this all back to something you mentioned a few minutes ago, which was this idea of real world satisfaction, seeing what's happening with your product. Your code is going out there in a product within a couple of months, even if you're a summer intern. So this idea of employee satisfaction comes back around to understanding what the company is trying to do. So you understand why. What is my role in achieving that? Do I agree with that role? And am I compensated fairly? So you've got the emotional and the financial paycheck.
Yeah, I was visiting a customer of ours and you know, they have existing tools and they're kind of looking at how they can transform their product development environment. And this is a company called Dexcom, very innovative company. And they're helping with people who have diabetes. And today, as an example, you know, if you have diabetes, you have to continue, you know, pretty regularly monitor your glucose levels. And the way that's done is through a pricking your finger and taking a droplet of blood and put it in this meter. And then it's either high or low. And then appropriately, you might take insulin shots or whatever else that you do to moderate it. But you can imagine that that is discrete in terms of the number of times that you can do it today, in a day. Imagine if you had a system that, in fact, could do it continuously and continuously monitor it. And that's exactly what Dexcom has built. They've built a device that for 14 days can be, you know, put on your stomach. And it's basically continuously monitoring and sending signals back out to your iPhone and iPhone app. And imagine that, you know, when it sees continuously that there's a decline, you can kind of adjust it before it's sort of discrete. So, you know, before you have these discrete drop-offs. Well, that's fine if you're an adult and you can, you know, you might get by pricking your finger and do that. Imagine if you're a child, you're not doing that all the time. Imagine if your child is young and sleeping. Like that was one of the examples when I went and visited and they explained they had a child that basically had their glucose monitor and the parents got an alert in the middle of the night that the blood sugar levels had fallen. And they literally were able to, you know, get the insulin levels higher. And if that didn't happen, you know, that child literally could have died in the middle of the night. So when you think about a product like that, you're like, oh my gosh, it's one thing to build, you know, the next consumer, I don't know, a coffee warmer or something. I don't know. But a product like that, you know, it just rips at your heartstrings in terms of the impact it can have. And so when I saw the Super Bowl this year and I saw Dexcom, I remember pausing it and kind of rewinding it and said to my wife, that's a company I was just out at. That's a company that's, you know, now using Onshape is going to try and transform its product development process. To me, that's the ultimate sort of example of motivation and emotional paycheck of people using a tool that you're building to help change the process that ultimately is changing healthcare and changing our lives. And so, you know, if that doesn't get you motivated, then please go work somewhere else. But for me, like that's the essence of what you want to do to engage your customers, but engage your employees.
Yeah, I like that example because not only does it really show the potential emotional impact that you can have from a product, you can actually connect to this. This is more than just a thing that you can make. But this actually shows how there's a downstream mechanism here where it's not just that you're helping engineers. So for example, your team at PTC, they understand that they are participating in the digital transformation of your customers. So your customers are able to collaborate better or whatever it may be. But that's all very, I would describe it as just kind of cold, routine, impersonal ideas of this corporate body that is becoming better at doing something. But the downstream implication of that is that what is it that they're becoming better at doing?
Yeah. I mean, we faced it in the education space with COVID. You know, we went from, you know, 100 and something thousand users to literally over 1 million users in 9 months in the education space. And the stories, you know, there was a school district in Kentucky that they took four of their different students and we didn't request it. They just made a video and sent it to us thanking us for how it transformed because they love their STEM class, but they couldn't use their kind of existing tools to do it. And they showed us some of the stuff they were doing. And it was like, you know, kids in their bedrooms showing, you know, you could see their posters behind them showing some of the things that they had done and built using Onshape with other teams. And so when you see that, you realize, you know, yes, the cold hard facts of business are extremely important. Don't get me wrong. But seeing how it affects people in their daily lives, you know, that's the emotional component that I think is equally important to the financials. And so that emotional impact is what drives people in startups to do, you know, kind of abnormal things that just very hard to do if you're kind of just 9-to-5-ing it. And so to me, that's always important to share with your employees, you know, throughout the organization.
When you try to find that North Star and that mission for existence, you need to understand all the way down to how your products are being, or the products that are being used by your customers are being used by their customers. Given all that we've talked about, what would you leave as a final takeaway for anyone who is interested in taking their organization to that next level in terms of innovation?
I think the world, no doubt, is getting more and more competitive in different geographies, different companies. So, you know, the ultimate winners are going to be people that create value for their customers. And that usually comes through innovation. And innovation can't be legislated. Innovation happens through people understanding what customers are trying to do. And customers often don't necessarily even know what their problems are. They just know what they're trying to do. And so the most powerful thing you can do if you want to create innovation in your organization is allow people to observe. And so creating freedom for them to go and see what customers are doing and not asking them, what do you want, but actually trying to see what they do in their daily jobs. And usually, if you understand the technology, you understand processes, that's where the innovation spark comes from, is observing, seeing where they're having challenges, seeing where there might be opportunities to transform things. And that's the role of a company. So if you're a leader and you're looking for more innovation, the question is, how many times are your people getting outside of your doors and actually getting in the seat of a customer and understanding what a customer is doing? Not necessarily having them tell you, but observing them.
Such a powerful takeaway. Thank you so much, John. Really appreciate it. One quick question, and that is for anybody who is interested in using Onshape or seeing what it's all about, what is the best way for them to find out more?
Go to onshape.com. You can sign up there. You can certainly talk to our team. They'll sort of reach out to you. We're pretty active on the forums. John Hirsting and myself jump in on things in the forums. People can access that directly. So onshape.com, and there's a whole slew of tools there. I'm on LinkedIn. I tend to try and respond to people when they reach out. So I'd say just look there, and we have a pretty vibrant community, and you know, you don't have to ask me, ask them.
All right, John, thank you so much.
Thanks, Chad.